How can goods be designed to eliminate environmental waste? It's the topic of this week's panel of experts from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford
on Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Dagelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation from Bridging the Gap. Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from Bridging the Gap.
So just a very quick couple sentences about myself. My name is Steve Attinger. I'm the director of the Business and Sustainability Group here in Palo Alto, which is a program associated with the Foundation for Global Community. And basically our mission is to help educate the Silicon Valley business community about best practices around sustainability. So that's what we specifically focus on. We have a number of different events that we produce, such as a sustainability speaker series that we host here at the Stanford Faculty Club. We produce a sustainability tour here in the Bay Area. And then this last summer, we had kind of our biggest event yet. In June, we had a two-day cradle-to-cradle conference, cradle-to-cradle design and intelligent materials pooling. And that was keynoted by Michael Braungart, William McDonough, and Peter Senge. Some of you may know those players in the field who are rather important in this field of clean products. And our group has actually been establishing a relationship with Michael Braungart over in Germany for about the last year and a half to figure out different ways of bringing the concept of cradle to cradle here to the Silicon Valley business community. So we've got a pretty close relationship with Dr. Braungart. So that's just a little bit about myself. And I'll go ahead and just kind of launch right in now to a little bit of the content and setting the context. I want to give you a quick, read a quick quote from the Wall Street Journal as of March 4th of this year. Companies making more ecologically friendly products aren't just trying to be fashionable. Consumers are increasingly seeking environmentally safe products and are sometimes willing to pay a premium for them. Because the makers avoid harmful substances, they are less likely to injure workers during the manufacturing process. And the economics of green design are changing, too. The recent run-up in the price of oil, for instance, has pushed up the price of petrochemicals and made it more cost-effective to recycle old synthetic material. And that was written in March. And think what oil has done in the last 6 months. So, again, Wall Street Journal, mainstream press. Okay, so a few other kind of setting the stage items. I want to give you a couple of statistics, and I'm just going to get these out of the way at the beginning of the day. They're kind of interesting. According to a recent study from the Government Accounting Office, 50 million computers became outdated each year, and studies suggest that between 315 and 600 million desktop and laptop computers will soon be obsolete. In its semi-annual report to Congress from November of 2004, the EPA concluded that the piles of e-waste are growing three times faster than normal municipal waste. And my favorite, which is over 30 tons of waste is produced for every ton of product that reaches the consumer. And then 98% of those products are thrown away within 6 months. When you include the hidden impacts of manufacturing, we each consume our own body weight in materials every 2 days. Or, if you're an American, every day. A little history on clean products. One of my favorites is Xerox. Back in 1993, they produced what they called their quality manufacturing process for take back of their products. And that began the process of designing some of their product lines for full take-back, disassembly, and reuse. In 1997, Xerox Europe, took back 160,000 machines, out of which they reprocessed 3.8 million parts. So when you take into account the increased labor costs associated with the take-back of the products the disassembling, the sorting, et cetera, taking all that into consideration, they netted $80 million as a result. That's not a bad return on investment, if you ask me. And in 1997, they launched Document Center's products, which basically support upgrades and add-ons. So rather than when a copier is no longer meeting the needs of a company, Xerox doesn't actually have to come and physically take the machine away and give you a new machine. Their Document Center was actually designed so that they could actually pull modules out, put in upgrades, and then actually add on modules. And this is my favorite. Their original machines had about 2,000 moving parts in them. After this redesign, which incorporated full design for environment, someone give me a guess. How many parts do you think they ended up with out of 2,000? Lower. 250. That's an 80 to 90% decrease in the number of parts. And they're more easily serviceable, et cetera, et cetera. And they saved money. So if you're interested, check out Xerox. It's a great case study. Oh, and by the way, as part of that process, not only did they adhere to the US EPA Energy Star standards in their design for environment specs, but they also naturally complied with the Germany's Blue Angel Eco Label certification and Scandinavia's Nordic Swan. Many of you may know that the Europeans are a bit further ahead than we are in terms of product take back and product stewardship, also what's known as extended producer responsibility. And those are just two of a number of eco labels, the most popular ones in Europe. So to kind of wrap up my section here with a couple other comments. So I talked a little bit about cradle-to-cradle design, and I kind of view that as being one of the best end results or desired end results in terms of product production. If you're not familiar with that concept, basically what it means is you take a product, it's used by the customer, it's taken back, and that product can actually be disassembled or ground down, reprocessed, and that same product can then be made out of that product. Unlike today's recycling, for example, if you have a plastic water bottle and you put that in the recycling bin, that cannot be made into a new plastic water bottle. It's actually downcycled into less quality plastic resin. So cradle to cradle is basically maintaining the quality and also with the added benefit that it's keeping all of the harmful toxic chemicals that are bound in these products actually out of the ecosystem. So it has a number of advantages. Cradle-to-cradle design actually is not entirely new. Back in 1982, there's a fellow named Walter Stahel, who actually kind of coined or came up with the original idea of product take-back and closed loop. And he produced some very technical documentation called, the Product Lifecycle Factor. So again, if you're interested in taking a look at that, Walter Stahel is his name, and he was kind of the father of it. William McDonough and Michael Braungart very much made this concept mainstream in 2002 with their book Cradle to Cradle. And so kind of everyone thinks of William McDonough as being the father of it, but I wanted to make sure that support was given to the person who actually, one of the people who actually came up with this idea. And finally, another point, if you're interested in researching this, in my graduate school, I was involved in taking a sustainable products and services class. And if you're interested in looking kind of more into it, there's a fellow named Edwin Datshefsky, which is Datshefski, and he is all about the ultimate in sustainable products. So he'd be someone who'd be very interesting for you to take a look at if you really are interested in what a sustainable product is all about. So, without any further, actually, one other very quick item, and we'll get on to our panelists. We'll talk a little bit more about this as we go through the day, but just to be aware of, there are a couple of European mandated directives that are currently in force or will be taking place. There's the WEE directive out of Europe, which is Waste, Electrical, and Electronic Equipment. That actually went into effect 90 days ago, and that lays down directives as far as trying to reduce and ultimately eliminate the electronic and electrical products that actually end up in the landfill. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And the second directive is called ROS, which goes into effect July of next year. And that actually has to do with eliminating certain specific toxic chemicals from the landfill altogether. So basically, companies have to produce their products without these chemicals in them. And those chemicals are lead, mercury, cadmium, hexavalent chromium, polybrominated biphenyls, and polybrominated diphenyl ethers. Those are things somehow or other I think our mothers would probably not, would rather us not coming into contact with. That's just kind of my gut level opinion. So, without any further ado, I will turn it over. Actually, let me give a quick bio here. So I'd like to introduce Ian Lavanino.
Good job.
Ian is HP's Imaging and Printing Group Environmental Manager, responsible for driving strategies that reduce the environmental impact of HP's products and therefore its customers across the life cycle of HP's imaging and printing products. In her 10 years at HP, Ian has developed and managed new product innovation processes, warranty and customer experience programs, and product reliability and materials development programs. Ian began her technical career as a research scientist on thin film gas sensors at Mosaic Industries, a startup company here in Fremont, California. She holds an MS degree in Stanford and a BS from Stanford and a BS degree from Rice University, both in materials science and engineering. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Ian.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be here and for coming to the panel. I appreciate it. As Steve mentioned, in my role, I do manage the environmental programs for our imaging and printing categories. And I wanted to start by just taking a couple minutes to say how I got engaged in that work and why it's important to me. And for me, it started about 4 years ago, where as a program manager, I could see where the company was coming from, where this particular division was coming from, and where we were headed to. At that time, we were hitting a hallmark of having shipped about 100 million printers in about 10 years of being in the category. And when we looked ahead, we knew that we were going to ship the next 100 million in less than 5 years. And it's today we've shipped over 400 million. So it's amazing number of products out there with what do you do with it at end of life, et cetera. The other thing that kind of came from the outside in for me is at around that time is when the transition in the top 100 economies went from being nation states as the majority owners to multinational corporations. And today, I think 53 of the 100 biggest economies in the world are actually multinational corporations. So here I am sitting in HP with those two facts staring me in the face. And for me, it made me really internalize the need for big companies like HP who have the capability and the responsibility to be working on these issues. And I wanted to be a part of working on those issues. So if you can go to the next slide, I want to share with you a little bit about our stewardship program. We have had a design for environment program since 1982. This means we have product stewards that are on every product category that work with the design community to set goals, both target and aspirational, for improving the environmental performance of our products throughout the life cycle. Typically, we focus on materials and energy, number of parts, the reliability so that people don't go through them as quickly. And we tend to set not only goals for in the design side, but also in the manufacturing and for customer use and for end of life. On the manufacturing side, it's not so hard to put in design for environment goals because you usually save money when you do it. And so there's a pretty huge motivation by the manufacturing teams to be looking at some of those at some of those options. On the distribution side, that can be true too. We have packaging teams that look at how to create effective packaging that's lower weight and does its job right. You probably have all had the experience of buying something that was just completely overpackaged so that you could drop it off the Empire State Building. You can do much better with much less and get the same result. you know, some of the successes here for HP. About 6 years ago, we redid the way we do our bulk packing when we're shipping things from Asia over to Americas into the Europe region. And just by simply taking them out of a box and bulk packing them, putting them on a slip sheet instead of a pallet, we're able to reduce the number of ships that are going across the ocean. I mean, it's just small changes that when you're talking about 400 million printers, it makes a big difference. Principle, a lot of our products are in the consumer space, and principle, and even in the commercial space, a big part of design for environment is how are your customers going to use the product and how can they save resources. There was a life cycle study done about 3 years ago, an independent industry source, where they said that actually 50% or more than 50% of the environmental impact of printing is in the production of the paper. And so if we can find ways for people to reduce the amount of energy, ink, or paper that they're using, we're going a long ways to improving the environmental performance of our products. And then lastly, at end of life, HP has been recycling, taking back computers and printers since 1987. We've collected over, you heard Vijay this morning, over 700 million pounds of that material. We have a 1 billion pound goal by 2007. And when we get them back, we take them apart. We peel out what materials we can that we can use in different places. If some of the products that come back, they are in good enough shape that we actually can refurbish them and put them back into a different use in another place. Now I'm going to show you just a couple examples of DFE. You can go to the next one for me, please. This product is a DustJet printer. It's the 6840. It has won an award from Analog Zone as a product of the year for its environmental performance. And this, you can see up here, there's a couple just liners about what did we focus on to improve the environmental performance of this product. The design for conservation, that's the part about the customer use side. So it has a duplexer. It has a fast draft mode that can use a little bit less ink. It has Energy Star, so it has the 1 watt or less in off mode. And then this other concept of that it's upgradable, that the product will grow with you so you don't have to buy a whole new product when your small business becomes a little bit bigger business. There's definitely the design for recyclability side of it. With all of our stewards, when they're looking at the products, they have what we call the RAT tool. It's a recyclability assessment tool where they go through and look at the number of parts, the types of plastics, the way it's fastened, and really try to optimize for end of life. An amazing thing in this, it's got 2 screws on it, and then you can take it apart, which is amazing. And this is a Blue Angel and Energy Star rated product. And I think the other thing to say about this particular one is that it's won that environmental award, which is nice. The stewards feel great about it. It's also won industrial design awards and performance awards in the mainstream. So it's a good combination of meeting multiple needs, you know, making the trade-offs and getting to a well-functioning product. And then the second example I just wanted to share with you is closing the loop of using recycled plastic back into our products. We had 5 products last year that we shipped with in our scanners. And the part that the green arrow is pointing to is, it's called the carriage cover. It actually carries the lamp back and forth. So it's a functioning part that has to move and handle a lot. And 75% of it is from plastic water bottles. So you may say they're downcycled because they can't hold food. But they're a very high functioning use of that plastic. And it's something that we want to try to build on going forward. I put in the picture there, the engineers, to just make a comment that, you know, you look at them, they're very proud, and they did a good work. The technical team did a wonderful job of finding a solution that worked for us. However, in the context of this conference, what's important to note is that it took a lot of cross-organizational alignment and partnership to make this go. And that would not have happened without managers in place who believed in it and pushed for it and made the dialogue happen to make it go forward. I think with that, I'll call it quits.
Okay. Thank you, Ian.
Uh-huh.
Our next panelist, I'd like to introduce Timothy Taylor. And he is president and CEO of Environmental Home Center, which is a Seattle-based home improvement and building materials store that carries products such as non-toxic paint, natural carpets, sustainable wood products, energy-efficient insulation, and people-friendly cleaning supplies. I like that, people-friendly. Not eco-friendly, people-friendly. Prior to joining Environmental Home Center, Tim was president and CEO of holding company Laird Norton Company, where for 6 years he managed the company's venture and liquid asset investments, including investments in Lenoga Corporation, which is one of the top 10 building materials retailers in the U.S., and also Triple Tree Corporation, which is involved in resort properties. Tim's experience also includes founding three construction companies, and he also played an active role as a founding member of the Investor Circle, which is a national organization designed to attract private equity into socially responsible and environmentally sound businesses. And while I think of it, I encourage you to take a look at the lengthier bios of each of our panelists in your booklet, because I'm just giving you kind of the top level, just in terms of brevity. But with that, I'll turn it over to Tim.
Well, thank you very much for being here. I think one of the things that is one of the most precious things we have is the sharing our time with each other. So mm-hmm. I do appreciate your being here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hit three things. One, just kind of go through my background quickly from a slightly different perspective. I want to talk about the company that I'm currently running and a little bit about why I'm involved in the field. I have a very peculiar background. I would categorize it in three areas: on the ground, in the boardroom, and on the firing line. On the ground, I've been a contractor, I've been a developer, I've been a spec builder, and I've actually spent a lot of time restoring houses that were built between 1700 and 1760. In the boardroom, I've been the CEO of a billion-dollar enterprise, traditional business, and have had the opportunity to sit on multiple boards of directors of very well-financed, fairly large companies in several different industries. And on the firing line today, heading up a fast-growing, it's sort of a 13-year-old startup, retailing sustainable building and finished materials. There are two common elements in all of this. Number one is, from a traditional experience standpoint, I never have had any of the traditional experience to do what I've done. I didn't graduate from college. I never got along with school. This is not a good organization to be saying that in front of. But and the second is, there's sort of a theme, a thread of sustainability between those three, starting with working on old buildings. I will tell you, when you take apart a 250 or a 300-year-old building, you begin to develop an appreciation for sustainability in the built environment. It is decidedly different than many of the buildings that are built today. Secondly, as one of the founders of the Investor Circle, understanding how private equity and capital can influence sustainability of businesses was a big impact. And the third, learning about sustainability in a 150-year-old family business, private holding company, gave me a sense of what it takes to maintain a business over 150 years, which is extremely unusual. Laird Norton Company is, as I said, a 150-year-old enterprise, celebrated its 150th birthday this year, and has over 400 shareholders, all of whom are related, seventh-generation membership on the ground. So one other comment on my background, and that is, I'm not recommending the circuitous route and the lack of experience. There's one thing that occurs when you try and do that. Number one is, you make a lot of mistakes, and I will assure you, I have made some huge mistakes. So number two is, if you want to take the route I've taken, you better learn from your mistakes, and you better learn pretty quick. The company I head up now is really a brand play as a specialty retailer of sustainable building and finished materials. We provide those to professional and retail customers, and we do that with comprehensive information, really great customer service, and competitive prices. We're currently located in Seattle. We have a 30,000 square foot facility. It's actually a little bigger than it was about a year and a half ago, because just over a year ago, we lost the entire business to a catastrophic fire. So there's all kinds of stories involved with that. There are three business units. There's the store, there's a web call center, and there's a distribution component to the business. The store serves both retail customers and professional customers. Retail customers are anyone who walks in the store. The classic retail customer for us is what we call the buy-it-yourselfer. It's not a do-it-yourselfer. It's the person who comes with a contractor, maybe with an architect, with a designer, maybe there's a timber framer, but they want to be involved in the product selection process. But they come with this constellation of parties that have to be served. The professional customers are anyone who's in the business of building. It can be contractor residential, contractor commercial. It can be a project manager. It can be a commercial developer. Architects, engineers, designers tend not to be customers. They don't write checks. But they are drivers of our business, so we do focus on them. But as far as being an actual customer, they're not that sort of core customer. We sell a full range of products from rough to finish. We sell 2x4s, panel products, plywood, insulation. We sell flooring materials, cabinets, countertops, paints and coatings. We have, we believe, the broadest range of materials of any company in the country. Part of the advantage of being a 13-year-old startup is you have a leg up on some other businesses. We focus more predominantly on the finish side because the margins are better and there's less competition. The web call center represents about 15% of our sales and is primarily retail and primarily national. Calls come in, they answer the calls, they're very sophisticated at converting those information-based calls into sales. And then we have a distribution business where we distribute to about 30 or 35 small green building material retailers around the country. It's mostly for intellectual capital on what's going on in those markets and prospective, you didn't hear it here, acquisitions down the road. So our products, by the way, come from Redmond, Washington, the other side of the lake. They come from Southern California. They come from Argentina and Portugal. So they span the gamut. We love local products, but you can't build a construction retail business based on local products alone. It's not like in the restaurant business. Our growth strategy is essentially get it right in Seattle, expand through a hub-and-spoke model on the West Coast with anchor stores in places like San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, L.A., Vancouver, with satellite stores, 1,500 to 2,500 square foot stores in markets like Bend, Oregon, Bellingham, Washington, places like that. Smaller but fast-growing markets. So why am I involved in the field? First of all, remember what I said about making big mistakes. The bulk of my experience has been involved in building, design, building materials. So focusing on something I know is probably a good strategy. I did learn that. I believe it's a great business opportunity for growing a business as well as for me personally. I'm doing this because I'd like to make some money doing it. I do it out of the kindness of my heart, but I also do it because I need to make a living. It's a tangible venture. Unlike what I consider sort of pushing money around, products and retail is very material and very tangible. Customers walk in the door. They like what you do. You serve them. Your sales ring up or not. You know, the business is also small enough to have a really meaningful impact in terms of implementing management strategies and different sort of practices. And I've got a lot of skin in the game. So I will feel pain if we fail. I will have pleasure if we succeed. And really the final component is that a lot of people don't fully understand the leverage and impact of the built environment. People focus on, you know, emissions from SUVs and they focus on all kinds of things. The built environment is statistically all the buildings that are standing in the industry. 65% of electric consumption, 30% of greenhouse gas emissions, 40% of raw materials used globally, 12% of potable water. It is a huge, huge industry and a huge impact on this planet. And if it's really big, it on the negative side, it has the capacity to be really big on the positive side. So fundamentally, I just want to be involved with a business that provides solutions.
Thank you very much. Our next panelist is Jill Kaufman Johnson, who is a principal with California Environmental Associates, which draws upon her program development and operations experience in environmental strategic planning. In this role, she helps clients develop new business opportunities as well as assess options for reducing enterprise costs and environmental impact. Ms. Johnson is also the co-founder and executive director of the Chemical Strategies Partnership, which is a national nonprofit dedicated to reducing chemical use in manufacturing through innovative supply chain approaches. She was a member of the team that launched the Roots of Change Fund, which is a foundation collaborative supporting work to catalyze the transition to a healthier food system and a healthier environment in California. Ms. Johnson holds a master's in public policy from Harvard University and a BA in human biology from Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me here. I am going to take a little different approach to clean, green products. What I've been doing the past 10 years is flip that idea on its head and say, what if we didn't need products? What if we could just go for the function of the product and turn that into service? So what I'm going to talk about is sort of the journey I've taken over the last 10 years to try to specifically work in the chemical sector, but we'll sort of end what I have my comments on where I'm seeing the same transformation happening in so many other industries. So how I got started in this was after grad school, where I had studied the concept of toxic use reduction, I got an opportunity to respond to a request from a large philanthropic foundation called the Pew Charitable Trust. They've given a lot of money to a lot of environmental organizations to pass a lot of policy around reducing chemical use by manufacturers. And so they thought, well, is there a different way? So they funded four organizations to look at trying to reduce chemical use and toxics from a market-based approach. So what we did is we looked around the country. What's the most interesting thing going on? And surprisingly, the most interesting thing going on was at General Motors. And what happened there was they were buying thousands and thousands of chemicals. They had 40,000 suppliers, and it was basically out of control. And so they finally turned to their chemical suppliers, and they said, you guys are the experts here. We make cars. That's our core competency. You come in and help us manage these chemicals. So what happened was they basically started to force the chemical industry to consider the concept of chemical management services. The idea that a chemical supplier comes in and they manage the chemicals for you everywhere from when it hits your shop floor to when it goes out the door. And as you guys would know, most of you know, a chemical is not like any other commodity. It's not like paper towels or pencils. There's a lot of management that goes along and cost to manage every chemical on your site. So they did this and they got sophisticated enough that they set their model to charge the chemical suppliers a flat fee for every car out the door. So that means, let's say it's $100 a car. They said, we'll pay you $100 a car. You buy all the chemicals and you provide all the services to manage that chemical through the process. The car has to be quality, you know, assured out the door. You get $100, and if you can do it for 90, that's yours to keep. You can do it for 80, that's yours to keep. So what happened was, where the chemical industry's traditional profit motive was sell more and more and more chemicals, now it's sell less chemicals, do it more efficiently, that's my margin to keep. So this model was doing very well. GM was doing so well with it. They basically average, every time a program like this comes into one of their facilities, they average 30% reduction in chemical use and 30% reduction in chemical in cost, overall management cost to the facility. And the sort of related emissions that go with that is, you know, unbelievable, just these staggering figures. Anyway, so after that happened, we saw that. We thought, wow, why isn't everyone talking about this? And of course, they're not talking about it because they're saving so much money. They don't want their competitors to know about it. So we started this organization to start taking that model and saying, well, would this work in other industries? And so 10 years ago, we tested in the aerospace and the electronics industry. And our basic approach was, let's test it in one or two leading companies. If it works, the market forces will make it, you know, make it replicate throughout the industry. We as a nonprofit can step away and start a new industry. So we took philanthropic funding, both we take private foundations and EPA, to fund this model. So since then, in the aerospace industry, nearly every single company in the aerospace industry today uses this chemical services model. We are now testing it in the forest products. We're actually working with Weyerhaeuser to look at the concept of the paper and how they make their paper and their wood products. We're testing it in universities and research and development. We're testing starting next month in the biotech. And the biggest of all, we are now working with the Department of Defense, who actually is the largest buyer of chemicals in the U.S., as you can imagine. Every Air Force base, everything that goes through it. So why is this interesting and why do I keep doing this for 10 years? The interesting thing here is we're talking about transforming the way business thinks about their product and their business. I don't know if you've heard that the CEO of Ford, Bill Ford, basically said, we're not a car company anymore, we're a mobility company. Think about function. Cars get people from A to B. What are we really in the business of doing? We've seen IBM, well, the Xerox is actually the best one. It was great, it was a good little header. Because with the Xerox, you don't buy a copier anymore. You buy a monthly service. You don't care what kind of copier you have. You just want copiers, the function. You want it to work. So someone comes in and services your copier every month, every half year. You just pay a service fee. And another example would be your answering machine. Who buys an answering machine anymore? The plastic, the wires, and all the stuff that took to make it. We buy voicemail now. So think about, and that's where we're going here. Chemicals is just one example, and we tend to be held up as one really good example to date. But there's often, there's opportunities in so many businesses to what we call dematerialize. You have less product and substitute that for more service. And what we're finding across the board is the profitability, the margins for these businesses are much higher than the commodity-based business. So that's what I have to say.
Great. I'm very, very glad that you brought up this whole concept of service rather than products. That's for anyone who's read the Cradle to Cradle book, that's one of the key concepts in there is can we move from products from a product to a service economy. Mm-hmm. Some different kinds of companies have tried that. You've got now companies that are providing your, for example, on your computer, your antivirus protection. It's now, an annual subscription fee as opposed to you buying the software, installing it, and then having to buy it again. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely more and more examples of this going on in our society today, and I think it's really kind of where the future is going. So I'd like to spend about 15 minutes or so going through some questions that our team has come up with, and I'll start with Ayan.
Okay.
So what would you say is working well in the IT industry around managing closing the loop?
Mm-hmm. You heard Vijay this morning talk about shared responsibility between producers and communities they're working in and the recyclers. And I think some interesting things in this area are some of the partnerships between not-for-profit and corporations and municipalities on this front. So for instance, in the U.S., we partner with the National Christina Foundation and with the Rethink Initiative that eBay made an announcement of last year at CES, I think it was. And it's a process of where, you're looking in the U.S. at folks having two or three printers in their home, perhaps, a couple of PCs that they turn over every two or three years just to get the latest and greatest. Well, there's definitely places in the world and places in the U.S. where the things that are only two or three years old are still pretty valuable and can be productive for the community. And so things like the National Christian Foundation, they will take that equipment back and redistribute it, to someplace where it can be used. So I think those kind of partnerships are a good example of where we're headed. You heard this morning about the supplier code of conduct for the electronics industry. This was something that HP kicked off because we were seeing a variety of requirements that varied from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and in some places no restrictions whatsoever. And we had our own code of conduct that we wanted our suppliers to live into. And so recognizing that, we weren't going to create competitive advantage and sell at a higher profit margin by having a code of conduct, but that if we could be a market force to drive widespread change, that everybody in the industry could come up a step in their performance. And so when we went into that consortium or formed that consortium, you know, we brought along Intel as a supplier. We brought along Dell and IBM as competitors. We brought along our four top CMs. And if you look at it, now just for perspective here, HP spends $52 billion in procurement every year. It's the largest in the IT industry. And so we, you know, we've set a goal for ourselves that with our audit process, we want to audit 99% of what we procure. And if we could just do that, we would raise the standard worldwide. So I think it's looking at things not necessarily because you're going to make money off of it, but because you can raise the standard across the industry, or you can find another way to move things around. And then you can talk about it with stakeholders. It's a brand value. I think those are really valuable examples.
Can you talk just real quickly, when you talk about the supplier code of conduct, mm-hmm. what's the relationship of that with the problem that we have with e-waste ending up in China and other various
So with e-waste in China or in Asia Pacific, it's a very interesting problem right now. Whereas in Europe, the WEEE legislation that passed in August is creating, in some places mandatory, in some places voluntary, systems for doing take back. In Asia Pacific, it's a wild west. There are no rules at all. While we do have take-back programs as a producer in Asia Pacific, you'll find that a lot of, there's one province in China where you see backyard incineration to try to recover the precious metals. And in that instance, you know, if it's not a structured situation where you have scrubbers and everything else, people who are doing that are ending up with toxics. They're breathing, they're inhaling it. And they don't know that, and they're not making the money off of it. So it's kind of a lose-lose in that situation. I think there is a real opportunity for the electronics industry to transfer what we've learned in Europe and in North America, and to work with jurisdictions and industry standards and industry forums in Asia Pacific to create systems that work. In Europe, I'll just give you an example. In Europe, it's a little bit easier because you got the EU, so you got one entity you can work at with. In Asia Pacific, there's none of that collaboration or cooperation at all. And so an industry standard is going to go further than trying to work country by country. In Europe, there's cases where we pay a fee by what we put on the market, and we have to put the stuff into one specific system. In other countries, right next door, we just have to make sure this stuff gets recycled. And so we set up a recycling system to manage it. The cost of implementation is tenfold different between those two systems. Because in the second, we can set up a competing infrastructure of recyclers and folks who are handling the waste and drive the cost down, just like we do with our, you know, our supply chain and our other operations. That's what we need to get to, and that's what we're talking about when we say shared responsibility, is get to a place where we have a market-driven system that is meeting some, you know, baseline standards and gets us to a place where there's people who are motivated to take it back in a safe way versus burning it in an open container, you know, in a backyard.
Thank you. Tim, is the green building materials market at or close to a tipping point? And to what do you look when you inform your opinion on that?
Well, first of all, let me just say it's always dangerous making that statement because it serves my interests to have reached the tipping point. So with that as an introduction, I think... the biggest thing that we look at in terms of validation that the market's reached the tipping point is something called LEED. And for most of you who are, or who may, you're probably familiar, but for those of you who are not, LEED is a green building performance-based standard. It has five categories. There are sustainable site plans, water and water efficiency, energy efficiency and renewable energy, conservation of materials and resources, and indoor air quality. Up until recently, it has applied only to commercial buildings. Currently, there are LEED standards for tenant improvements, new construction. There's a pilot program for residential homes. If you look at the statistics, 289 certified projects completed, 2,000 registered projects on the books, that's 235 million gross square feet of building. Projects in all 50 states, 13 different countries. Pretty incredible adoption. The same can be said for some green builder programs on the residential side. So sort of from a quant's perspective, that's what we look to the most. I think more anecdotally, I live by both. I love the big stuff and I love the little, everyday sort of indicators to me. Generally speaking, I would say 10 years ago, you'd be hard-pressed to find any major manufacturers of building materials that were talking about green building or recyclability or sustainability or any of that sort of thing. And today, you'd be hard-pressed to find a major manufacturer that isn't talking about it. In some cases, it may just be rhetoric, but at least it's rhetoric. And in a lot of cases, it's real. A couple of other anecdotal things. By the way, LEED has been adopted by California, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Washington, the Fed, GSA, General Services Administration, U.S. Air Force, Department of State, DOE, EPA. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. It is transforming the marketplace. Anecdotally, interestingly enough, in the last 3 weeks, I've been contacted four times by MBA students in different places around the country doing projects on sustainability in the built environment, green building materials, green building material retailing, et cetera, et cetera. I've been contacted by three businesses, this is in the last 3 weeks, asking me, can we partner, can we franchise, can we do what you're doing, we want to start up in X, X, and X. And it's accelerating daily, literally. I think one of the more compelling anecdotal things is I was interviewed a couple weeks ago for an article that will be published, as I understand it, in February on how green building has hit the mainstream that will be published in the Harvard Business Review. And one of my favorite stories, anecdotally, is I brought along a little chart. Visual aid. Again, I want to say this is a classic example of how not to run a business. I don't know if any of you can see this. This is a chart going the wrong direction. Can everyone see this? That is actually our marketing dollars. That's not as a percentage of revenues. That is hard dollars. From 2000 to 2004, going from 160 to 134 to 105 to 100 to 55,000 annual budget for marketing. Over the period from 2002 to 2004, we saw an 111% increase in our new customer sales per ad dollar. At the same time, we increased sales from our existing customers by 86% over that same period. We've got people coming in the front door at high rates of speed, and we are retaining them as well. So, I want to say part of that is we're good. We do a good job. But part of that is we're in a really hot industry. So,
LEED for residences.
Yeah.
Is that in effect already, or is that
pilot programs in several cities?
Okay. We had David Gottfried doing an event for us a few weeks ago, and I remember him talking about that. And that was exciting for me to hear because LEED has been so compelling in the commercial sector.
Right.
And now that they're actually moving toward having that be something that's viable for the residential sector.
The market is significantly more fragmented, so adopting LEED on the residential side is going to be a lot harder.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot harder.
And from my perspective, one of the things that I've actually anecdotally but encountered is through myself also directly and also through people that I know that are either doing building their own home from scratch or from remodels, is they might actually even say to their general contractor or material supplier, I'd like you to do some of these things with green materials, reuse materials, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times what I'm hearing is they're getting pushback because these people don't even know it and understand it, and they don't want to know about it. They know how to get their limber or their lumber right. from their current source, and they don't right. want to worry about FSC certified. Yeah. So I can see why that's going to be a much bigger yeah. kind of fish to fry.
When I started at the company in 2000, about 11% of the business was with professionals, and it was 50% last year. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly to satisfy that issue. If we can't service a professional, mm-hmm. the market's not going to grow. Mm-hmm. It's not going to become mainstream. Right.
Great. Great. Joe. The goal of green product design and products is to generate less toxic, more sustainable products for the marketplace. Sounds good. What about designing, for dematerialization, either striving to use fewer inputs to produce more product, or consumers using fewer products but realizing more functionality? And do you have any examples? Or do you feel like you talked about that in your intro and you want me to...
No, I did, but I can speak to it a little bit more if you want. I think there's two issues to think about dematerialization. One is the way in which a product was manufactured. So looking at the actual manufacturing process to make a printer or a piece of timber, lumber. The other thing to think about then is the product itself, what's embodied in the product that goes out the door. Is that less toxic? And is that also sort of dematerialized? It sounds like with your printer, you guys have gotten to this point where you probably use less pounds of plastic and all that kind of thing. So I think when you think about the world of dematerialization, we sort of look at both sides of the, of the equation right now. And the work that I do with the chemical services stuff, it's really on the production side. It's really not on what's embodied in the product. But if you look at the product side, certainly the answering machine example I gave would be a good example. It's completely eliminated at this point. There's no longer even a need for the product. And you guys, I'm sure many of you have heard about the interface carpet example. Mm-hmm. On the product side, you don't buy carpeting anymore. You buy carpeting service, and someone just makes sure that you always have carpet that's clean and looks good. And at the end of the day, dematerialization can also, on the sort of on the books, what it looks like as well is that, for instance, for carpets, I no longer have to put an upfront cost of, let's say, $10,000 to buy my carpet for my office space. I now can pay $1,200 a month or whatever, $500 a month to have that carpet service. So in terms of your an investment purpose from a customer's perspective, you can talk about amortizing costs as sort of an annualized cost as opposed to an upfront. That's actually really unique, and it's really for customers that's really attractive. So that's what we've seen as well.
And a small little add-on to her comment about carpeting. Interface was kind of the Ray Anderson, who is their CEO, he read Paul Hawkins' Ecology of Commerce a number of years ago, kind of was struck by this lightning bolt and proceeded in ensuing 10 years or so to try to, in essence, bring sustainability into every facet of the business. And he's had a number of successes, and he's had some real difficulty kind of bringing that throughout the entire culture. One of the differences with Interface's product actually is has a recycled backing. And this is just kind of what I'm about to tell you is the way different products feed into, for example, what Tim was talking about as far as lead. Interface's products have recycled material backing, which gives them points under the lead certification. Now, Shaw Industries, which is Interface's direct competitor and is actually the largest flooring manufacturer in the world, has produced a true cradle-to-cradle piece of flooring. And actually, under LEED, they don't get the same credit, even though it's actually a more advanced product. So just something to think about. But both of them do offer this ability with carpet tiling where you can literally peel it up. There's an 800 number on the back. Call them. And then you can, in essence, you can send the tile back and they just replace that one little piece, which is fantastic.
Steve, there's a quick comparison on the building side. Mm-hmm. Dematerialization is don't build a 77,000 square foot starter castle. Build a 2,500 square foot house or a 1,500 square foot
refurbish,
house.
Refurbish, right?
Right. Yeah.
Great point. And just we'll go with you for a second here again, Jill. How do you attain a price point? This is a very much interest to me. How do you attain a price point that can compete with non-green products, or do your products carry a premium price?
That was my question for these guys. I sent you that question for these guys.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to shoot it back to you.
Well, yeah, there we go.
So one comment I would make. We, being HP, we obviously are selling into multiple segments of customers. And we really, the only segment, if you look at the Roper Starch data, Roper Starch does this, Green Gage has been doing it for 20 years, right. And every year reports on consumer attitudes about environment. Only 10% of consumers in the U.S., at most, 5 to 10%, will actually differentiate on environmental performance. Our public sector customers, which is government, federal, school, education, that kind of thing, they often have minimums, bare minimums that we have to, you know, that are beyond legal requirements that we need to move into. And we can't be competitive unless we have the environmental performance. We have yet to find, unless you can show some sort of financial benefit to the customer, like the duplexing saves mm-hmm. them paper, or Energy Star is going to save them their energy cost, it is extremely difficult to sell up on environmental or to get a price premium. It's where the customers are just not there yet.
But are you able to produce it at the same price as a traditionally produced printer?
That's the win-win. If we can get to parity on that, I can drive the decision. If we can't get to parity, there better be a darn good reason longer term, a darn good business reason longer term why we would invest more. Because it's just, it's so, it cost us a lot to add in stuff.
Yeah. My answer to that would be, this is a huge bone of contention with me in the way a lot of businesses are sort of portraying the whole, particularly on the building material side, the willingness of the consumer to pay more, which drives me insane, because in our case, it's funny you ask, I brought some How to Go Green on a Budget, which I have if anyone wants to take them. But basically, we lay out a building, and we lay out a series of finished products, and we compare them to the conventional, and guess what? It's cheaper. First cost. Excellent. Not more expensive, and I think, you know, I think in the end we really and your circumstances may be a little different, mm-hmm. but I think we really do a disservice by saying, perpetuating this, mm-hmm. the consumer is willing to pay 5% more, 10% more. Mm-hmm. In the end, where this whole thing is going, it's actually going to be less. Yeah. I mean. Mm-hmm. It really will be less, because companies are going to pay the price
full accounting.
Right. Yeah. One way or the other. And today, we're really lucky in our industry, because there are a huge number of products. And one of the things we do with most customers is we make sure people understand that they have the right comparison. And mm-hmm. most of the problems come when we allow a customer to walk out of the door thinking that the place and press, 75 cent a square foot piece of crap PVC based tile that they can buy at Home Depot, which might last a couple, 3 years, and then it's ripped out in junk and landfilled, is not an apples to apples comparison okay. to Marmoleum, true linoleum with a 40 year mm-hmm. commercial life that's completely biodegradable. Mm-hmm. And when you compare Armstrong's PVC-based designer solarium through color floor with our floor, ours is actually less expensive.
Yeah, doing the life cycle cost of it.
No, first cost.
Yeah. First cost. Oh, excellent.
First cost.
Excellent.
Yeah, you get all the other stuff for free.
You know, the other thing I was going to add to it is one of the ways that we're able to create change over the longer term is to have foresight to, you know, on the energy stuff, you know, that's a ASIC that's got a 3 to 5 year development window.
So it's next generation.
So being able to plan ahead and make it part of the normal development life cycle, mm-hmm. Recycled plastics is going to be the same way. Very hard to get in right now because there's not a supply chain around it. There's not assurance of supply. But if we could get it to drop in to existing design, so you don't have to change the tooling, you don't have to change the part drawing, you can use it when it's available, or you go back to virgin when you have to. Yeah. That kind of, your integration plan needs to be a long-term and deliberate, and you need to have, you know, the design requirements that allow you to move towards
right.
that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
and interesting, Ian, that you're just now mentioning the concept of more long-term thinking. Mm-hmm. And I'll just quickly tie that into what Al Gore was saying yesterday morning, which was his opinion that not only our government, but also the market sector really has a responsibility to start thinking more long-term. Mm-hmm. And as long as we are in a mindset where we can, quote, externalize the costs to the environment, basically off the books, mm-hmm. and there is no precautionary principle that's being followed, mostly, you know, largely in this country, you know, he made a very strong point about that, and that's something I think that we need to continue to bring up with companies. HP is clearly the leader in the efforts that they're making in this area, and there's still a long way to go, yeah. and that's exactly what Gore was highlighting yesterday. So, you know, thank you for bringing that in.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Bridging the Gap Conference.
Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Sheila Setharaman. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.